This is the December 9 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Aaron Curtis from Midco out of Bloomington, Illinois, Chuck Shelby of Risk Management Commodities in Lafayette, Indiana, and Bill Biederman from AgMarket.net in Spring City, Tennessee. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's public radio for the farming world. Find us online at WILLHE.org or search us out in your favorite podcast application. Just look for Commodity Week. Aaron Curtis, we'll start with you today. Can you review that export figure that dropped by 75 million bushels from corn? I think the trade expected it. Did it really mean very much to the marketplace today?
Yeah, not a lot. I think the corn was expecting something closer to 50 million when you looked at the average guesses on the Indian stock. So it got 75. It could have gone anywhere from 50 to 100 million. If you look at our bushel commitments, you know, as of Thursday's crop report or export sales report, you know, we're running about 50% of last year's numbers. So to say the corn export program has been fairly slow is probably a little bit of an understatement. But, you know, you look around the competition, we've got Brazil shipping corn to China. We've got the Black Sea corridor, you know, remained open. So Ukraine continues to ship out a little bit of corn, continues to be a pretty cheap option, especially for those folks in the Northern Africa, European area. So, yeah, we just continue to be kind of a residual supplier now on corn again. So we still got, I think, a window here. We get into Jan through March where, you know, South America will start to run out of some supplies and we'll have a window there where we could see some improvement in exports. But obviously the pace to this point has been pretty far behind what we were accustomed to. So it kind of forced the USDA to have to adjust that number here this morning.
As they adjusted that number, they also took the cash grain figure down for the season's average price or the whole marketing year by 10 cents from $6.80 a bushel to $6.70. Does that feel better to you?
I think it does. Yeah, you can see what futures have done here over the last few weeks. We've dropped, 50 to 60 cents off our high. So it kind of speaks to really what's going on in the corn market, which is really not a whole lot. Of course, wheat has not helped at all. Wheat's obviously dropped considerably more than what corn has done. So that's kind of pulling on corn futures as well, but just kind of speaks to the ho-humness of the export demand and just really not a lot of excitement in the corn market right now with what we're seeing around the world. Of course, we're kind of in the middle of a little bit of a weather story here, continuing to watch dry weather in Argentina. Brazil looks pretty good. So the USDA did not adjust Argentina corn production. So you may call that a little bit of a surprise today, but there's still anticipation that the weather starts to improve after we get to after the first of the year in Argentina. So I think USDA is kind of punting on that a little bit to see what happens here over the next month or so. But, you know, Brazil slated to have a record crop as well. So we're going to need either some more substantial weather issues in South America, some sort of political disruption, or some better demand here to get the corn price back up and going, as it continues to be pretty quiet in corn futures.
Indian stocks, of course, raised that 75 million bushels that they took out of the export market. Now at 1.257 billion bushels left over by the time we get to the fall of 2023 for corn. I'm wondering, as you think about domestic usage at this point, if there are pitfalls moving forward, because this is a small number, and we're still at a high price. Are there pitfalls moving forward that can change things?
Yeah, you know, stocks to use ratio is still a little bit under 9%. So, you know, relatively on a historical basis, still fairly tight. So one of the things we're watching closely, right, crude oil continues to kind of grind lower. And as that relates back to ethanol margins, right, especially if you get out west where they've had to pay some pretty good basis numbers for some corn to move through the fall, right? So as we kind of look out through the curve, ethanol margins look like they're going to tighten up and could continue to deteriorate a little bit, especially if energy prices continue to work lower here as we move through the winter. So that would be something we keep an eye on. What does that ethanol margin look like as we move into the winter in the first half of 2023? Like I said, we still got a little bit of a window here where we think exports could improve a little bit on corn, but we got a lot of catching up to do there. And then, you know, this feed number is going to be interesting to watch. Todd, we know that the Western corn production was down substantially. If you look at kind of the six states that kind of feed into some of those feed markets, they were, you know, roughly 660 million bushel less corn this year than last year. So we continue to see corn move from east to west. And, you know, you start doing some math on, you know, what some of that corn price has to be landed into Colorado and Southwest Kansas, talking, you know, $8 a bushel on corn. That gets pretty pricey to continue to feed animals. So we'll continue to keep an eye on feed numbers and cattle and hog numbers here as we continue to move forward at some of these higher prices. But exports, the ones that are going to get the most attention here this winter, to see if there's any improvement here as we move into the first half of 2023, Todd.
I'd like you to stay with the feed for just a moment. USDA having usage for feed and residual at 5.3 billion bushels. That's unchanged from last month. Avian influenza has been within the United States now almost for the whole of the calendar year, USDA has said. It's been a problem. Of course, we've seen flocks that have been decimated. Although this is the largest category for feed usage, it doesn't seem to have had that much of an impact. Why do you suppose that's the case?
Yeah, I think it's still kind of a wait-and-see process, right? Because, you know, from the poultry side, obviously per bird don't eat a lot of corn, but it does add up when you're talking about millions of birds. And sometimes, you know, obviously you can replace or reproduce flocks much more quickly than you can in cattle and hogs. So, you know, the fact that the feed number, you know, was substantially less than a year ago. If you look year over year, they've got feed and residual down about 400 million bushels. So that seems to be a little bit of a, maybe too hard of a drop as we get through the year. But, you know, these numbers we're going to continue to have to keep an eye on, because when you're talking about some of these high prices, you know, how sustainable is that for some of these producers to continue to feed corn at some of these landed values? You know, once you get it from the Corn Belt to some of these further out fringe areas, it gets pretty expensive. So we're going to continue to have to keep an eye on this feed number moving forward. But there's an opportunity for that feed number maybe to increase a little bit here as we move through the year. And we got a quarterly stocks report out on January 12th that may give us a little bit better idea on where that feed number lands, at least through the first quarter of this marketing year.
And finally, I'll stay with corn. Are farmers caught up on sales per usual, or where they normally are at this time of year, or are they lagging behind?
I think it's pretty standard to usual. It is behind what they've done the last couple years. If you go back to 2020, when we rallied corn futures through the fall, when China came in and bought corn from the U.S. coming out of COVID. And then last year, we had some good prices and rallied you know, during fall as well, and saw some increase. We saw the producer much involved in marketing across the scale harvest time. So we owned quite a bit, or the elevator system owned quite a bit of corn coming out of harvest most of the last 2 years. This year, corn market's been quite a bit quieter to weaker. So I would say based on the, compared to the last 2 years, Todd, the farmer owns a little more corn than what he has, just looking for that post-harvest rally. I think if you look at what we've done the last 2 years, I think the producer would probably say he sold a little too early. And this year, I wanted to see if there was that same post-harvest bounce, and the market has not cooperated up to this point. So I think there's still some marketing to do on old crop corn. And I would say quite a probably 50 to 60% of the beans got put in on DP or storage. We have seen farmer rewarding this little bean rally that we had up towards $15 this week, but there's still quite a bit of pricing to do on soybeans and then corn as well here as we move through the winter, and you know, quite a bit of deferred income as well. So just you know, we're looking at a scenario where a producer just doesn't need a lot of money, and that still influences a lot of marketing decisions.
Aaron Curtis, of course, is with Midco. He's in Bloomington, Illinois. Chuck Shelby is here as well. He's at Risk Management Commodities in Lafayette, Indiana. As we were wrapping up with Aaron, he suggested that farmers were not as far along on their corn sales at this point as they have been in the last 2 years, but more like 2020. I suppose the question at this point, given today's USDA report and that 75 million drop in the exports, is, should they be further along and should they start making sales?
Well, I think producers, typically, when they just get done with harvest, it's hard to turn right back around and sell. But the dynamics of the market have changed a bit because we haven't been able to really see the big exports in corn like we've seen in soybeans. So producers are sitting back, waiting. In some areas, the basis has improved, but in other areas that had a big crop, it seems to be pretty flat, not really moving. So the challenge is going forward for producers. The market knows there's bushels out there that aren't sold, a little more than normal. But producers probably need to look for an opportunity to make those sales and look maybe to some re-ownership if that's what it takes to, you know, make them feel comfortable with a lot of unknowns yet to go in South America.
Does it make much of a difference whether you're in the eastern or the western Corn Belt, meaning that the western Corn Belt certainly has a better basis than the eastern Corn Belt would have?
Well, the problem out there for those producers is they certainly had the much poorer crop. But you come back into parts of Illinois and Indiana near Lafayette, we have a really strong basis going. But you look at a crop in areas south of Lafayette and to the east and west, not such a good crop. So I think that's why the basis is stronger here. But going forward, you know, we have a lot of end users in the east, and I think the basis will probably come back around. The question is, how high can the futures market go? And will that combination of higher futures not change the basis, or vice versa, futures doesn't go up, end users need some, and they push their basis and improve it? So I don't know if we're going to go much of anywhere, but I think we can get a little higher price of corn so producers can make some moves.
And then when you think about soybeans in this mix, are producers willing sellers, or should they be willing sellers on this last rally?
Nah, a lot of producers have been more willing to sell soybeans. They like the price. If you're in a good basis area, you know, you're getting $14.50 to maybe $14.80 or $90 cash price. So that seems to be a price that's satisfying them. Interesting to note the new crop November beans, one of the highest prices we've seen at this point in time. So a little bit of interest there on new crop soybeans. So they're more inclined to let beans go here than corn.
Can you tell me a little bit about the fundamentals that you've been watching in both the corn and soybeans, and start with corn and what you think that picture looks like?
Well, the market certainly is aware of the fact that we haven't been able to keep up on exports. We have seen China be really absent from the corn market. One thing about it, though, it's a really tight carryout. So at 1.25, the price being where it is, we don't have a lot of room to export corn. If we exported a couple hundred million bushel, we'd be down near a billion bushel, which means the price would have to be a lot higher than where we are today. So at this point in time, fundamentals could change if China came in and bought just a little bit of corn. Another factor we've been watching fundamentally is Argentina has been a meal mover and a bean mover in the marketplace. But they're the third biggest exporter of corn, and if they've got problems and that continues, that could trigger some world buyers to step into the United States, considering how much corn Argentina sells into the world.
So this is an interesting balancing act because you have Brazil, who have a safrinha crop, not even in the ground, won't be for several months now, with corn, which now enters the export market. Argentina with corn also that really isn't in the ground at this point, but suffering a very, very large drought. Farmers thinking, hey, should I hang on to some all the way to July? It's a balancing act that you have to think about and risk that you need to manage. What do they do with bushels that they don't price?
Well, there's some put options out there that aren't terribly expensive to create a floor underneath you. There's a lot of unknowns that are good and bad. I think this is a perfect time, though, to use some of those tools because it could go either way. And you look at the old crop. What are the acres going to be? Right now, there's a lot of projections at 92 million corn, 87 beans. But like last year, we didn't feel corn acres would be that big. I could see the mixture being closer to 89 and 89 again. So a lot of unknowns. When you have unknowns as a producer, you know, again, we have ability to use some of these option tools to offset our risk no matter which direction you want to go.
You mentioned the soy complex. Soybeans, of course, have been a player out of Argentina as they have used it politically, and there were beans coming out of that country a couple of times, late in the summer, early fall, and then again recently. Have they done with that at this point? Have they gotten rid of enough beans that really they don't have left anything left in the bin, and then that turns us to the drought conditions there?
I think they probably exhausted their supply. Also, they may look at the current weather scenario going on down there and say, we don't want to let any more go because of what the crop prospects might be. So I think that program probably kind of ran its course. It pushed the market down for a while. Interesting to note, though, every time we push the bean market down, we've seen world buyers step up to the plate and become big buyers on corrections in the bean market. So there is underlying support down there. I think the question going forward in the next few weeks or month would be, do we see more world buyers decide that this is a good time to step back in?
Why do you think that is? Are they hunting the vegetable oil out of it, or are they needing the meal, or both?
Well, the meal market would suggest that they're after meal now. Our bean oil in the United States price got pretty high based upon the ideas that, you know, we're going to expand the blend, which didn't happen. So we've seen that market correct. But I think considering how big a producer and exporter of meal Argentina is, the market got a little bit concerned about that. It seems like we're kind of in just-in-time mentality with inflation and everything else that's the war. A lot of world buyers tend to be right now, I think they just buy when they need to, and it just shows up all at once, and then they pull away for a while and they wait to see what develops.
Any final comment for me?
Well, as everybody knows, they're going to have a much higher input cost as producers next year. It's going to be really challenging. I think, again, the swings, good and bad, for price for producers is going to be extremely difficult to manage. But there will be opportunities. We just have to deal with it as always, and it's going to be a challenging year.
Chuck Shelby is with Risk Management Commodities. He's in Lafayette, Indiana. Bill Biederman is here as well. He's with AgMarket.net in Spring City, Tennessee. Bill, first, your assessment of this morning's USDA report, what meant most to you?
Todd, I think it was right in line with expectations. Typically, this is a report that they don't make changes on, and they didn't make many changes other than that small revision in corn. Even the world stocks numbers didn't change much. So, you know, overall, I thought it was a report that we needed to see just get out of the way. And, you know, it wasn't bearish. What was negative on the U.S. Exports was made up for with over a 2 million ton drop in world carryover in corn. So totally neutral. And, you know, we're going to focus on a sideways market through the holiday, most likely.
I'm going to guess that this report did not change much for your marketing plans as it relates to old crop or new crop corn and soybeans. Can you bring me up to speed on where you think producers should be?
Well, we've been pretty well hedged for the old crop. And on the new crop 23 next year, as soon as we started advising people to get their inputs bought, which was a while ago, we also advised to get, you know, about 50% of your inputs sold using an option. And that way, worst case scenario, if this turns into like another 1975 or a 1989 where we had tight stocks followed by good production and the market just kept falling, also in 75 we were dealing with a deflationary fiscal policy much like we are now. So those 2 years were really disappointing if you were holding on hoping. And so we just thought, you know what, we know what our inputs are, let's just get them covered. We got 50% of our crop locked in with an option. If it goes up, we're going to make more. If it goes down, we're going to be able to pay off bills. So that's the approach we took, Todd. I know it's kind of a simplistic approach, but, hey, we're sleeping at night.
I'd like you to turn your attention to a couple macroeconomic issues. I want to talk about COVID in China, but you did mention fiscal policy last week. Jerome Powell basically said, look, we're nearing the end and we're not going to move as quickly or as high with interest rate hikes in the month of December, and we'll continue to probably back off as we move through the coming year. What does that mean for you as it relates to commodities?
Well, the fiscal policy overall is not changing. The fiscal policy designed to deflate the general price structure that we live in, get our cost of living down. That's going to mean most likely that we're going to see some layoffs. We might see unemployment get up to 4.5%, maybe 5.5%. Who knows? And when the people lose jobs, they're going to quit buying gadgets. And when they quit buying gadgets, the gadget prices come down more. And that's deflation. And in food, obviously, we're at the mercy of weather, right? So food could come down a lot, but not a whole lot, because of the fact that we got to eat, right? But we don't have to buy a shoe, and we don't have to buy that gadget. So those are the things that are really going to deflate the most. Food will be the last thing, and it'll need a supply revision there. The other thing, too, is the high interest rates are going to cause these housing prices to most likely really suffer a little bit. And when there's layoffs, they're going to suffer a little more. So you don't have that refinancing going on and that extra money to start going out and buying a car or building things. So the whole economy is really going to be moved and directed by this fiscal policy. And they aren't going to just turn on a switch and say, okay, we're going to have deflation. And then a couple of months later say, oh, switch is off. That's not going to happen. So what Powell said is we're going to continue. We're not going to raise rates 75 basis points at a time, but we are going to continue with this deflationary process until we see things get more in balance. And that means balance means interest rates versus inflation are about well balanced. Whereas for the long time, we had zero interest rates and 4 to 8% inflation. That's unbalanced. So we got to get to equilibrium, Todd.
You think they'll be able to pull it off?
I think they will be able to pull it off. I mean, there's going to be a little hurt with it, but they understand that, and I think everybody understands that. I think the wild card, Todd, is going to be if there's something that is socially or militarily unexpected happen, like, you know, all of those riots in China, that really wasn't expected. Or if Putin decides to miscalculate some kind of a reaction and there's some kind of a nuclear thing, which I don't expect. I mean, the whole world's putting pressure on him to not do that. But if that something like that were to happen, that would be a miscalculation that the Fed couldn't figure in. And that would be a big deal. But overall, the trader, the investor, the New York money is going to be trading this deflationary policy. Whereas here in agriculture, we're all like, well, yeah, but it's still dry in Argentina and it's really dry in the U.S. plains. Well, that has a minimal impact until it's really bad.
How do you view the COVID policy changes in China and their impact?
Okay, fascinating story. It's my opinion, and this is just my opinion, is that China, rather than raising interest rates like the rest of the central banks, China controlled their inflation problem with COVID, restricting people to go to work, restricting productivity. That brings their economy down. But the most, I guess it's kind of an ingenious way of doing it, is that they're able to keep their interest rates really low, like 0 to 1%. So when their economy softens to where they want it and they start to reopen, their businesses are back in business, doing business at very little cost of finance versus ours, which have gone from 0 to we went to look at a farm the other day and it was 8% mortgage versus 2. And we're like, we can't afford that. It won't cash flow. So, you know, the contrast of how we're doing things with high interest rates versus them, stay at home, don't work. But when you do come to work, your company is going to be doing business at a very low cost of doing business. I mean, that could spark a very smooth recovery on their part. Versus ours. I mean, I think ours will be good. It's going to be a little bit of hurt, but theirs was just kind of manipulated.
You're not worried about COVID becoming an issue this winter for them and the impact of it?
I have no idea, Todd. I don't know. All I know is that, you know, when I'm looking at how they do things, and I've been studying them for 40 years, it looked to me like the COVID restrictions were more based on economic hidden agenda than they were health. And granted, they don't want COVID. They don't want people dying because that creates social unrest. But look what keeping the people at home did. I mean, they've had a lot of riots there too, just like we did. I mean, it doesn't matter what country it is. If you lock people up, pretty soon they start to revolt. And that's exactly what happened. Now look at the revolting, and that should be a super spreader event. But I mean, I don't know if their numbers are spiraling right now or not. Spiking. I mean, I'm not sure. I'm just saying that from an economic standpoint, I think that they're set up to recover quicker economically or more stable than what we have to go through. We're going to have to go through readjustment to balance interest rates and inflation.
For agriculture, this should be good news. They should need inputs, corn, soybeans, other inputs, in order to keep that economy that you say should come out smoothly really running at a pace.
And right now, you know, they're still consuming 295 million tons versus the 274 they're producing. So now, you know, I think this is the fifth or sixth year, you know, we're averaging about a 20 million ton deficit. And, you know, still they still have the largest majority of end stocks of corn, 206 million metric tons versus, you know, the world has 300. But point being, what you just said is well said. Now, their imports are estimated at 18 million tons. I think that that's a pretty solid number. We have a group of guys in the company that are international traders, and they like that number of 18. They think that's very doable. The big question is, what percentage of that is going to be U.S., and what percentage of that is going to be Brazil, since Brazil is now becoming a player in that market?
That's for corn. How about for soybean?
The soybean number, again, USDA's number is, I believe, 98, and that's probably about as what is expected for them to import. There's doesn't seem to be a whole lot of issue with that one right now.
Any final bit that we ought to talk about?
I think watching the stock market going into January, February is going to be critical. If that thing's deflating, it's going to be it's going to be a caution flag that's up in the air. But I will say this, that we still only have an 18-day supply of beans. And if you take the last week's export sales, which exceeded what we need to run for USDA, and you figure that that pace won't be canceled down the road, we're down to a 14-day supply of soybeans in the United States. We've still got a very, 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 very tight situation. And same with corn, 31-day supply. So here's the story. Until that supply buffer is made more comfortable, end users are on the edge of their chair, because if anything goes wrong with a production cycle in South America or North America, these end users are going to be really difficult to get their needs covered. So there's going to be good support under the market to hold it, and that should keep us held while the upside is restricted because of all of this economic stuff we talked about. It should be in a sideways market unless weather gets really bad, and now we're fighting over the last kernel. The top goes off, inelasticity goes out the window, or the opposite of that. We have good crops, the bottom end of that trading range comes out, and now we really start to deflate food also.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. You may listen to the whole of the program on our website anytime you'd like. Just click and play from willag.org or search Commodity Week out in your favorite podcast application. Our thanks go to our panelists this week, including Bill Biederman. He's in Spring City, Tennessee, and with agmarket.net. Aaron Curtis joined us from Bloomington, Illinois, and Midco. And we were also talking with Chuck Shelby of Risk Management Commodities today out of Lafayette, Indiana. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.